Chapter 12.
Some day, perhaps, said Schwartz, our time will be known as the Age of Irony. Not the witty irony of the 18th century, but the stupid or malignant irony of a crude age of technological progress and cultural regression. Hitler keeps shouting that he is an apostle of peace, and that other countries have forced war upon him. He not only tells the whole world he believes it himself. 50 million Germans believe it with him. The fact that they alone have been arming for years, and that no other country was prepared for war, doesn't affect their opinion in the least. It was just one more irony that those of us who had escaped the German camps should have landed in French ones. You couldn't even be too indignant about it. A country that's fighting for its life has more important things to worry about than perfect justice for refugees. We weren't tortured, gassed, or shot, just interned. What more could we expect? When did you see your wife again? I asked. Not for a long time. Were you at Le Vernet? No, but I know it was one of the worst of the French camps. Schwartz smiled ironically. That's a question of degree. Do you know the story about the crabs who were thrown into a pot of cold water to be boiled? When the temperature of the water rose to 120 degrees, they screamed that it was unbearable and moaned for the happy time when it was only 100. When it went up to 140, they moaned for the time when it was only 120. When it was 160, for the time when it was only 140, and so on. Le Vernet was 1,000 times better than the best German concentration camp, just as a concentration camp without gas chambers is better than one with gas chambers. I nodded. What happened to you? Soon the cold weather came on. Naturally, we didn't have enough blankets, and there was no coal. The usual mismanagement. But unhappiness is harder to bear when you're freezing. I won't bore you with a description of winter in the camp. It's too easy to be ironical. If Helen and I had admitted we were Nazis, we would have fared better. We'd have been sent to a special camp. While we starved and froze and suffered from diarrhea, I saw pictures in the papers of interned German prisoners who were not refugees. They had knives and forks, chairs and tables, beds, blankets, and even their own mess hall. The papers wrote with pride of how well France was treating enemy aliens. There was no need to treat us refugees with kid gloves. We weren't dangerous. I adapted myself. I took Helen's advice and discarded the idea of justice. In the evening, after work, I sat on my bunk, a straw pallet, 3 feet wide and 6 feet long, and worked on my state of mind. I trained myself to consider this period as a time of transition that had nothing to do with my personal self. Certain things happened in my environment, and I learned to react like a clever animal. Heartbreak can kill you as easily as dysentery, and justice was a peacetime luxury. Did you really believe that? I asked. No, said Schwartz. I had to keep dinning it into my head. It was the little injustices, the smaller slice of bread, the heavier workload, that were hardest to take. You've got to learn to ignore these daily irritations, or your resentment of the little things will black out the big ones. So you lived like a clever animal. Yes, until Helen's first letter came. That was 2 months later. It was sent by way of our hotel in Paris. I felt as if a window had been opened in a dark, stuffy room. Life is still outside, but at least it exists again. Her letters came irregularly. Sometimes there was none for weeks. It was strange how they changed and strengthened my image of Helen. She wrote that she was doing all right, that she had finally been sent to a camp and had been working first in the kitchen, then in the camp store. Twice she managed to send me a package of food. How, with the help of what dodges and bribes, I can't imagine. I began to see a new face in the letters. How much of that was due to absence, my own desires, the caprices of imagination, I don't know. Everything takes on almost supernatural proportions when you're isolated and reduced to a few letters, you know that. A word dropped at random, that would mean nothing if written in other circumstances, can become a thunderbolt that shatters your existence. And another, just as meaningless as the first, can give you weeks of warmth. You spend whole months mulling over things that the writer forgot the moment the letter was sealed. A photograph came. Helen, standing outside her barracks with another woman and a man. They were French members of the camp staff, she wrote. Schwartz looked up. How I studied that man's face. I borrowed a magnifying glass from a watchmaker. I couldn't make out why Helen had sent me the picture. She had probably thought nothing at all when she sent it. Or had she? I don't know. Have you ever felt that way? Everybody has, I said. Prisoner's psychosis. There's nothing exceptional about it. The bar owner brought us our check. We were the last guests. Is there some place else we can go? Schwartz asked. He told us of a place. They've got girls, he said. Nice and fat, not expensive. Isn't there anywhere else? Not that I know of at this time of night. He put on his jacket. I'll take you there if you want. I've got nothing to do. Those girls are pretty sly. I'll see you don't get cheated. Can't we sit there without the girls? Without the girls? The man looked baffled. Then a grin spread over his face. No girls? Oh, I see. Sure, of course. But that's all they've got, just girls. He looked after us as we stepped out into the street. It was a wonderful dawn. The sun wasn't up yet, but the salt smell had grown stronger. Cars crept through the streets. The smell of coffee and sleep was wafted from open windows. The lights were all out. We heard the rumbling of an invisible cart a few streets away. Fishing boats blossomed like yellow and red water lilies on the restless Tagus, and below, pale and still and without artificial light, lay the ship, the Ark, the last hope. We went toward it down the hill. The brothel was pretty dismal. Four or five fat, slovenly women sat smoking and playing cards. After a listless attempt to engage our interest, they left us in peace. I looked at my watch. It won't be much longer, Schwartz said. And the consulates don't open until 9. I knew that as well as he did. What he didn't seem to know was that telling and listening aren't the same. A year seems like an eternity, said Schwartz. And then it doesn't seem long at all. I tried to escape in January when we were working outside the camp. I was caught 2 days later. The notorious Lieutenant G lashed me across the face with his riding whip, and I was given 3 weeks in solitary on bread and water. On my second attempt, I was caught right away. I gave up. It was just about impossible to move without ration cards and papers. Any gendarme could pick you up. And it was a long way to Helen's camp. Then our situation changed. In May, the real war started, and 4 weeks later, it was over. We were in the unoccupied zone, but word went around that an army commission or even the Gestapo was going to inspect the camp. I guess you remember the panic that broke loose? Yes, I said. The panic, the suicides, the petitions to release us first, and the bureaucratic incompetence that often prevented this from being done. Not always. Sometimes there was an intelligent camp commander who released the refugees on his own responsibility. Some of them, it's true, were picked up later in Marseille or at the border. In Marseille. By that time, Helen and I had the poison, Schwartz broke in. Little capsules. They gave you a fatalistic peace of mind. A pharmacist in my camp sold them to me. Two capsules. I don't know exactly what it was, but I believed him when he said that you'd die quickly and almost painlessly if you took one. He said the poison was enough for two. He sold it to me because he was afraid he'd take it himself some night, in the hour of despair, just before daybreak. We were lined up like clay pigeons. The defeat had come too fast. No one had expected it so soon. We didn't know yet that England would not make peace. All we could see was that everything was lost. Schwartz made a gesture of weariness, and even now we can't be sure it isn't. We were pushed back to the coast. Ahead of us there was only the sea. The sea, I thought, and ships that still cross it. In the doorway appeared the owner of the bar we had just left. He greeted us with a grin and a mock military salute. Then he whispered something to the fat whores. One of them, a woman with an enormous bosom, came up to us.
Tell us how you do it.
What?
It must hurt like hell.
What? Asked Schwartz absently.
The way sailors do it on the high seas,
shouted the bar owner from the doorway, laughing so hard I expected him to spit out his teeth. The professor has been kidding you, I said to the woman, who gave off a wholesome smell of olive oil, garlic, onions, sweat, and life. We're not fairies. We were in the Ethiopian War. The natives castrated us.
You're Italians?
We used to be, I replied. Eunuchs have no nationality. We're cosmopolitans. She thought it over a little while.
Tu e comiki,
she then said solemnly, and wagging her giant posterior, she went back to the door, where the bar owner took her in hand. It's a strange thing about hopelessness, said Schwartz. Your ego's gone. You don't even know who you are anymore. But still there's something in you that clamors to live, and how obstinately it clings to sheer naked existence. Sometimes you feel a perfect stillness like the dead calm sailors tell about at the heart of a typhoon. You give up, you're like a bug playing dead, but you're not dead. You've only abandoned all effort to concentrate on sheer survival for its own sake. You are wide awake, but absolutely passive. You have no strength to waste. The typhoon is raging all around you, but you are becalmed. Fear and despair are gone. Even they are luxuries you can no longer afford. The energy you spent on them would detract from your will to survive, so you block it off. You're nothing but eyes and detached, passive readiness. A strange, serene clarity comes over you. In those days, I sometimes felt like a yogi who casts off everything that has to do with the conscious ego in order to... Schwartz faltered. To seek God? I asked, half mockingly. Schwartz shook his head. To find God. We're always looking for him. But we look for him as if we were trying to swim with all our clothes on and a full field pack. You've got to be naked as in the night when I left a safe foreign country to go back to my dangerous homeland and crossed the Rhine as though it were a stream of destiny, a narrow strip of moonlit life. In the camp, I sometimes thought of that night. It didn't sap my strength to think of it. It made me stronger. I had done what my life had demanded. I hadn't failed. I had gained a second heaven-sent life with Helen. And even the despair that had come to me and still haunted my sleep from time to time was possible only because there had been something else. Paris, Helen, and the unbelievable feeling of not being alone. Somewhere... Helen was alive. Maybe she was living with somebody else, but she was alive. It's horrible to think how much that can mean in times like these, when a man is less than an ant under a boot. Schwartz fell silent. "Did you find God?" I asked. It was a crude question, but all at once I was very eager to know. "A face in the mirror," Schwartz answered. "Whose face?" "It's always the same. Do you know your own? The face you had before you were born?" I looked at him with consternation. He had used the same words before. "A face in the mirror," he repeated. "And the face that looks over your shoulder and behind it, another. But then suddenly you yourself are the mirror with its endless repetitions." Now, I didn't find him. What would we do with him if we did find him? We'd have to stop being human beings. Just to look for him, that's something else. He smiled. "And then I didn't even have time and strength enough for that. I was too low. I could think only of what I loved. That's what kept me alive. I stopped thinking of God. Or justice." The circle had closed. It was the same situation as the river, repeated. Once again, I was on my own. When that state sets in, there's nothing much you can do. You can't even think. And it's not necessary. Thinking would only confuse you. Things happen by themselves. From the ridiculous isolation of a human being, you've returned to a world of anonymous events. All you need is to be ready. Ready to go when the invisible hand taps you on the shoulder. You only have to follow. As long as you don't ask questions, you'll be all right. You probably think I'm talking mystical nonsense. I shook my head. I know that feeling. People sometimes get it in times of great danger. Soldiers have told me about it. For no reason, something makes you walk out of a dugout that had all the appearance of safety. A moment later, a direct hit turns it into a mass grave. "What I finally did," said Schwartz, "was impossible, but it seemed like the most natural thing in the world. I packed up my belongings. Then one morning, I walked out of the camp. Most attempts were made at night. I went to the main gate in broad daylight and told the sentries I had been discharged. There were two of them. I waved Schwartz's passport. At the same time, I reached into my pocket, gave them some money, and told them to have a drink to my health. They didn't even ask to see my discharge. How could it occur to those two young peasants in uniform that anyone would have the nerve to leave by the main gate if he wasn't supposed to? I walked slowly down the white road. After the first few steps, I felt as if the camp gate had turned into a dragon and was sneaking up behind me. But I didn't run. Calmly, I put Schwartz's passport away and went on. There was a smell of rosemary and thyme in the air. The smell of freedom. After a time, I pretended my shoelace had come undone. I bent down and looked back. No one was following me. I began to walk faster. I had none of the many papers you could be asked for in those days. My French was fairly good. I hoped people would mistake it for some dialect. The whole country was on the move. The towns were full of fugitives from the occupied zone, and the roads were swarming with vehicles of all kinds, many of them piled high with bedding, household utensils, and escaping soldiers. I came to a little inn. Off to one side a few tables had been set up, bordered by a kitchen garden and a small orchard. The taproom was floored with tiles and smelled of spilled wine, fresh bread, and coffee. The girl who waited on me had bare feet. She laid a tablecloth and put down a coffee pot, a cup, a plate, and bread and honey. What luxury! I hadn't seen anything like it since Paris. Outside, behind the dusty hedge, the shattered world moved by. Here, in this privileged spot beneath the trees, there was peace. The buzzing of bees, the trembling golden light of late summer. I drank it all in as a camel stores up water for a trek through the desert. I closed my eyes and basked in the light and drank.